Good evening. I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education. It's my pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. Tuesday Evenings, for any of you who are new to the program, is a weekly lecture series that runs this spring through April 8th. I invite you to check the listings with descriptions of each lecture on the Modern's website. Tonight, we are fortunate to have Stephan Kamar and Richard Burkett here from the legendary New York-based Artist Space. The Artist Space was founded in 1972 as a pilot project for the New York State Council on the Arts with the goal of assisting young emerging artists. If you know the history of this extraordinary space or institution, you know how important it has been to the presentation, documentation, support, and development of ideas from a time in which artists joined forces to create the scene that we now know of as the 70s, to this present moment when artists are again finding strength in numbers and testing boundaries. Stephan Kamar, as director of, as director of Artist Space since 2009, after being director of the Institute of Visual Culture in Cambridge and the director of the Kunst Vernon München, has honored this long and profound history while encouraging evolution and current relevance with physical and programmatic changes. He, along with the Artist Space staff and board, ushered in the 40th anniversary in 2012 with transformations of the exhibition space at the Green Street location and the addition of a second venue, Artist Space Books and Talks, for lectures, screenings, performances, and symposia, as well as, I have to say, an absolutely ingenious formula for a bookstore. Artist Space, in true innovative fashion, was featured in the 2012 Whitney Biennial. Contributing to these developments, Richard Burkett, former curator of the ICA London, was appointed curator of Artist Space in 2010. Clearly another good move in the institution's evolution in that Stephan and Richard have co-curated several very interesting projects, including Identity and Bernadette Corporation 2000 Wasted Years. Most recently, they collaborated with Julie Ault on the current exhibition, Macho Man, Tell It to My Heart, collected by Julie Ault, which seems to altogether represent the history and mission of the Artist Space with what the New York Times critic Colin Cotter called the diary of an era that valued community as retold in a time that doesn't. While I might dispute Cotter's analysis of the present, he effectively brought to mind the lives lived and ideas presented and preserved through Artist Space. And tonight we have the opportunity to learn more about this venerable organization, this effort, which since its inception has set the bar. Please join me in welcoming Stephan Kamar and Richard Burkett as they share their unique insights into the history and current life of Artist Space.
Thank you, Terry, and thank you to the Museum of Fort Worth for inviting us here. It's great to get away from snowy New York, basically, to a sunny climate. So we're going to speak. My name is Richard. This is Stephan. We're going to speak for around half an hour, maybe a little bit longer, working through a little bit about Artist Space's history, speaking specifically about that, how that history has influenced how we work now and the current structure of Artist Space, but also to use that perhaps as a way of reflecting on some of massive transitions in the last 40 years around how artists work, how institutions work, and particularly the alternative space movement that Artist Space has been very much part of historically. So Artist Space was founded in 1972, as Terry mentioned, as a pilot project for NISCA. It was founded by Irving Sandler, who's an art historian, very venerable art historian, and Trudy Grace, who is a kind of arts administrator working with NISCA. And the premise was really something that ran parallel to a certain kind of movement at that point in time in the early 70s in New York towards a need for spaces for younger artists, artists not represented by the museum system, by the commercial gallery system in New York at that time, to have space to work, to exhibit, and to test ideas, essentially. So Artist Space, in a way, is unusual because other organizations that started around that time, such as 1112 Green Street, that went on to become White Columns, were founded by artists. 1112 Green Street, by Jeffrey Liu and Gordon Matta-Clark. But with Artist Space, it was founded by an art historian and arts administrator. And somewhat contentiously, in the early 70s, Artist Space was awarded a significant grant from NISCA to begin its activities, whereas those other organizations really had no money. They were working, everything that went into the organization was what the artist community put into it. So there was a kind of period of time, I think, when Artist Space was really finding its feet in relation to that landscape, but certainly contributing to this kind of question around what a space for artists could be in that that period in the 1970s. So I think Artist Space very quickly found its real sense of value, if you like, for the artist community as a social space, as a community space, supporting artists through grant-giving facilities, a slide registry, but also one that was about the kind of open use of space for activities that weren't prescribed by the institution. So while the organization was doing a regular program of exhibitions, it was also opening the space up in the evenings for performances, screenings, and so on. And that's where the kind of life of the organization really took hold, and it became a very important institution in that sense in the mid-1970s through these kind of through this use by the artist community.
And one should probably also not forget that if you talk 1970s, that there wasn't really an art market. The access to the larger institution, MoMA, Whitney, was limited for so-called emerging artists. So there wasn't really a network or an infrastructure, commercial or public, for those artists.
So in a way, the kind of that role of Artist Space in providing an arena, a kind of platform for increased visibility for artists, really kind of coalesced in the mid-1970s around the first kind of curatorial director of the institution, Helene Weiner, who joined in 1975. And that was a kind of important shift for the organization. It was the first time that there was a curatorial program that came into view rather than a kind of semi-bureaucratic structure in which anything could happen. And it also kind of ushered in a period where Helene worked with a group of artists who she'd kind of become familiar with, working artists who were originally based in Buffalo in New York and moved to New York as young artists to work in the city. And that kind of really formed into a generation that we now know as the Pictures Generation. Cindy Sherman worked at Artist Space from 1975 through to the late 70s, both as a kind of front of house person, but also very much kind of involved in a discourse around that group of artists that she was involved in and that Helene was involved in. So this is actually a photo by Cindy Sherman that was published as an advert for Artist Space in Cover magazine in the late 70s. And you can see it's the staff of Artist Space, but really posed in a Cindy Sherman-esque kind of way. So this, what we know as the Pictures Generation, is known as the Pictures Generation because of an exhibition at Artist Space that took place in 1977 called Pictures, curated by Douglas Crimp, included artists such as Robert Longo, Sherry Levine, and it kind of brought together this community, and although certain artists like Cindy Sherman weren't involved in that exhibition, in that period of time, a very familiar roll call of artists who were investigating kind of image production and a kind of what we now know to be a kind of postmodern attitude towards image production all had solo exhibitions at Artist Space or were involved in group exhibitions, and it really was a hub for that theoretical discourse. And in a way, that's where Artist Space found its initial kind of burst of energy, if you like, around the notion that it was a space for ideas as much as that question of artist visibility. As I say, it was very important in that period in terms of not just exhibition making, but performances, talks, lectures, meetings even, and very politicized as well. This is an Adrian Piper performance that was really kind of dealing with questions around the critique of institutions and early questions around identity politics, around gender, race, and so on. And in a sense, that kind of fusing of the generation of artists that we now know as the picture generation and postmodernism and so on, and institutional critique, was very important to how Artispace was functioning as a critical institution. And if we move forward a little bit in the history of Artispace, the 70s and 80s were really kind of delineated by this approach. Helene left in the early 80s to form Metro Pictures, the gallery.
Which is, just like as a insert, which is kind of interesting that someone who worked in an alternative space grouped around herself a group of artists, the Pictures generation, then went on to, in the early 80s, to open her own gallery called Metro Pictures. So, and that's also some of the dilemmas that with an increasing of the art market activity or the emerging of an art market in the early 80s where it left the alternative space, but we will go into that further.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very important point to make, that this kind of halcyon days of the alternative space movement in the 70s quickly was challenged by a very burgeoning art market in New York, and one that the alternative space movement had obviously worked to bolster, in a sense, through this increased visibility for artists. And I think that's kind of interesting through looking at the history of Artispace in the 80s, where there was challenges from all directions, really, both from a question of its relevance to younger artists, to artists who, in this accelerated market system, who are still looking for ways to work outside of that, the question of how that is politicized, but also with the Reagan administration in the 80s, the kind of lack of money that was coming towards organizations from public funds. So
the money, essentially the completely dismantling of any public money for cultural sector. I mean, not only just shortening, it's essentially the total dismantling of any public responsibility and money towards culture.
Yeah, so I mean, that's a massive shift in that period of going from being healthily supported by the NEA and NISCA to nothing, basically. And this kind of shift really came to a head in the late 80s, at a period in which Artispace was not necessarily centrally, but certainly peripherally involved in activism around the AIDS crisis. There was a kind of a period in the late 80s where we're kind of familiar with the challenges to funding of organizations who were showing the work of artists like Robert Mapplethorpe, Andre Serrano, and so on. And in 88, Artispace put on an exhibition called Witnesses Against Our Vanishing, curated by Nan Golden, which was really a kind of pivotal moment for the artistic community in celebrating the work of artists who had passed away through AIDS-related illnesses, artists who there was a kind of a real concern that their legacy would be forgotten. And it's a kind of seminal exhibition in our history. But one of the kind of pivotal parts of that was that David Wojnarowicz contributed an essay to the publication that was produced for that show that was highly critical of the NEA, of Jesse Helms, of the Catholic Church, of the lack of response to the AIDS crisis. And as a result of that, the NEA withdrew their funding from Artispace, from that particular exhibition.
They never got any funding ever again until today. Probably.
Yeah. And I mean, it was a very contentious point in our history because Susan Wyatt, who was the director at that time, really challenged the NEA, insisted that they go back on that decision. And the end resolution was they funded the exhibition, but they didn't fund the catalogue. David Wojnarowicz was particularly outraged that Artispace would proceed on that basis. And so it was kind of like a moment in which Artispace had to deal with how politicized it was really how far it was going to go in that kind of question of its funding status. This is an image of Dave Wojnarowicz reading his catalogue essay, Artist Space, during the course of that show with his Reagan mask on. And this is the kind of protests that were held outside Artist Space at that time. So in a way, we're kind of focusing on this particular period as a kind of sea change for Artist Space. And we also, Stefan particularly, and like, we'll go on to talk about this, look towards a certain moment in Artist Space history around this time that as to how to kind of consider this, the kind of position of Artist Space when he joined. And that was this exhibition in 1988 by Michael Asher. It's a joint exhibition with Michael Asher and James Coleman. And it was very a simple proposition by Michael Asher. As you might know, Asher, an artist commonly known within the label of institutional critique, someone who very much considered the nature of institutional space as a kind of as one of power and authority. And he took Artist Space had recently moved to a new venue, and they'd contracted an architect to design the exhibition space. You see the walls here didn't go all the way to the ceiling. That was a particular architectural gesture. A year later, Michael Asher's proposition for his exhibition was merely to add the extra 2 feet to those walls to go straight to the ceiling, to add to the real estate, to add to the space that Artist Space had to show work. So a kind of critique of the fact that the alternative space had become merely about that question of visibility towards market ends, the kind of real estate of the white wall space. And that's certainly something that fed into the thinking around Artist Space now.
Yeah, so when I started in 2009, Artist Space was, I guess one can say, in a crisis. Where its historical legacy left itself. Where is Artist Space position with in its own legacy? And it sort of failed throughout the 90s, as many other so-called alternative organizations throughout that period failed to find their own feet again. Partly because the market has taken over. Or the market has no morals in that sense and is able to also absorb critical positions. And in a very diversified market, the positioning of what is considered alternative, radical, critical, political has been also become part of the market itself. As much as in an increased privatized institutional context, the currency of the contemporary has also become a diversified tool to attract different donors, supporters, etc. So for me, the question was really, what happened here? How can at some point in an organization's history, Michael Asher have made such a critical statement? And how do we take our own history forward into the contemporary? What does it really actually mean being that organization that showed all these critical positions once you really do not change your own infrastructure as an organization? By that point, I think Artist Space had barely artists on the board anymore. It was always a point of Artist Space that 50% of its board members had to be artists. It sort of functioned a bit as a springboard for emerging artists, but why should you use public money to test run artists for the market if the market is much better in providing that service? So when I started, I found Artist Space. Maybe you can have the pointer.
Oh yes.
Richard's first image was the open space where people hung out, sold films. Sort of chill out atmosphere. When I started in Artist Space, and that's prime real estate Soho, also that someone shouldn't forget that Artist Space was always a downtown organization. So where in the early 70s nobody would go to Soho, it was too dangerous. Now you go there to buy your Louis Vuitton, Acne, trousers, handbags. So for me also the question was, do we remain in Soho, or are we just closing shop and move somewhere else to Bushwick? But I think it is important to be a sort of critical reminder of the cultural history of Artispace. So, for example, Artispace had its own archive on site, which is ridiculous. I think you always know that an organization is kind of doomed when it gets busy with its own archive. So the first thing I did, we sold the archive to NYU, the Fates Library. They can look much better after the archive. And I also think as a contemporary organization, you should not be busy with, you should look forward, not kind of shoulder clap yourself on the legacy importance of your own history. So that was an important move. But you can see, that, you know, my office when I started was the Vista corner of between Grant and Green Street. You had the development director right next to me. So in a way, kind of Artispace became sort of a little Lego Playmobil version of a bigger institution. So it, without consciously realizing it, it totally appropriated a mainstream institutional architecture. And not only architecture, as well as thinking. So what we started is very simple, maybe the next pictures, just to get it all out, you know. And this is not only a metaphor for architecture, the same clearing happened on board level, where I think we literally together, because I was in a luxury position, I didn't have to take the job at Artispace, so I sort of asked for a year of free rein that I can do more or less what I want. So we reappointed about 80% of the board, and with the board jointly critically rethought the role of our organization. So essentially the first exhibition then also was an artist who is in his, Polish artist, grew up in Paris, lives in London, who from whom we restaged the work from 1972, meaning the year of Artispace founding, and the work had the title of Enough Tyranny, which was also his critique on the sort of heteronormative canon of minimalism of the early 70s. But also, of course, can be read against the foil of the pressure or narrow thinking that Artispace at that moment of time found itself in.
So what is... perhaps just to move on from that floor plan that you saw, that it literally, Stefan, took all the walls out, even to the point where the office in Artispace is totally visible as you walk in as a kind of audience member, a viewer, to see an exhibition. Typically, there is no kind of separation between the office, the workspace for Artispace staff and the exhibition space.
But also, I failed to mention that. Makamil Shamovitz, that was his first ever American one-person show. There's not only something like emerging, there's also something as re-emerging artists.
Maybe, Stefan, you say a bit about how you formulated the kind of structure of the exhibition program at that point in terms of what kind of programming that the organization would begin to do that transitioned from...
Well, I kind of it's sort of based on an understanding of being Artispace means, unlike any other organizations in New York, we are an organization that is for artists. That is a huge privilege. We are not dreading to say this here, not a donor-led organization. We are an organization for artists. When I was on a Saturday at Artispace and saw Francis Dark, Trisha Donnelly, and Rachel Harrison coming at the same time looking at Mark Emil Shamovitz's exhibition, I knew we were on the right track. In a way, I understand as kind of Artispace as a maybe union club for the artists living and working in New York City. And this doesn't mean only young artists, this really means there's three, nearly four generations of artists living in New York. And this doesn't mean we are showing them locally, local artists, it's rather setting impulses that create a fruitful, critical, self-reflexive dialogue within New York City.
I think that's a really important kind of thing for us, is that considering historically this move towards visibility, this overarching kind of need for this transition for the kind of young, unknown artist to gain visibility, to then have traction with a museum kind of led, commercial led kind of career, we are kind of at this point in time trying to say, you know, what does that mean, that that's been the kind of 40-year history of an organization like Artist Space? That's one kind of very smooth kind of neoliberal history of what an organization like Artist Space can be about. But we also want to think about not just that question of visibility, but one of criticality and how an institution like ours functions as a challenging organization.
And also everything has become so narrow thinking within New York in a highly profit-orientated context. I mean, one can't put it differently. The thinking of artists, of everybody, is geared, or seems to be geared, to only one goal. And one completely forgot that organizations started out with some different vision of the world and a different artistic practice.
And I think it's kind of interesting that we tend to try and feel about the exhibitions we do as programmatically rather than isolated instances. So what's important for us is thinking about how certain concerns and strands run across the programming that we do. And I think it's, for us, quite important that we can see that from beginning till what we're doing now.
I think we never conceived like, oh, it would be nice, we do exhibition with artist X, Y, Z, and then we do this. It's more like we're looking at a 2 years program where sort of a narrative unfolds and where things relate to each other. And not only exhibitions, also what's going on in the bookshop, talks, etc., where it's sort of cross-references our activities.
And so this early exhibition, when Stefan joined by Duncan Campbell, who's a young, still young artist living in Glasgow in the UK, very exciting filmmaker, and this particular work called Make It New, John, really resonates, you know, it still resonates for us in terms of our program, because it focuses on the story of John DeLorean, and as you know, the DeLorean car. It's very kind of iconic car, but iconic because of the failures economically of that kind of model, but also the ambition of the model. So the film is basically a documentary about, a kind of experimental documentary, if you like.
And it was also paralleled with a car crisis within the US.
So kind of looking at the particular economics of the 80s and kind of very, you know, fast, accelerated movements around the labor market and production. So John DeLorean was a forerunner in kind of moving the production of the DeLorean car to where the money was, essentially. So he went to Northern Ireland, where the kind of UK government gave a huge kind of like stipend, like input of money in order for this to happen, in order to boost the job, the kind of employment kind of situation in that part of the UK, and it totally failed. It kind of like collapsed, the organisation collapsed, the DeLorean car firm.
But it's also, the narrative here is also to say that the problems are not new. Globalisation is not new. The phenomenology is inherent within the economic system.
I'm optimistic, yes. Yes, we worked too long and too hard to let a few little aberrations bother us. Obviously, the most serious problem that an automobile company or a bank faces is the illusion of credibility in the marketplace. As soon as people think you're fragile financially, nobody wants to buy your car. It makes good sense. It's like a run on a bank. As soon as somebody says there's a problem, the failure becomes inevitable because everybody will go take their money out of the
bank. How serious a problem is it that your company faces?
Lauren, can you tell me how the meeting has gone earlier today?
I don't have any. I'm just going to go into the meeting now.
Are you hopeful that there'll be a good outcome?
I have no idea.
So that kind of like line, the illusion of credibility in the marketplace, is so resonant with that moment in 2010 when this exhibition, Duncan's exhibition, was up. But also trying to, you know, begin in a sense a discourse around the abstraction of current economies that we're working with, both how they relate to notions of artistic production as much as transitions from Fordist labour to post-Fordist labour. The exhibition with Charlotte Poznanski was, again, kind of engaging with that, both engaging with a history, an artist's history that's totally marginalised and wasn't present at that stage in a kind of art history within the US particularly. Maybe you can talk about
it. Yeah, it's a German minimal conceptual artist who shown with Conrad Fischer in Germany. So, I mean, she wasn't totally unknown. She knew American art. She traveled to America, but yet was never, her reception was never within the legacy and history and hegemony, if you want, of the minimal discourse, which is kind of hegemonial to the U.S. So we staged her first one-person show. I mean, she's not only dead, but she also stopped making art in 1972, again, the year of Artist Space founding, studied sociology and became a union activist. And her work at Lifetime was sold, but only for production costs. So she took the surplus value out of the work. Until today, the work is only sold to the production value. Are you speeding a bit up because we're looking at the time?
Yeah.
This is Jan Bo, artist who fled Vietnam in the 80s. His first institutional exhibition in the U.S., which... He befriended by coincidence someone who was working for the RAND Corporation, an anthropologist who was going to Vietnam to prepare the war, essentially, but was also taking pictures of Vietnamese, predominantly male youth, sort of, you know, homoerotic attraction. Jan met that person in a residency in Los Angeles. The person got expelled at some point from the military because of his homosexuality. Jan bought from him, he bought from him his archive, and then we represented the photos that he took before the war in Vietnam or during the war in Vietnam at Artist Space, and sort of covered all gallery windows in curtains which were embroidered with motifs from plants in Vietnam, with a sort of first colonization from the French and sort of encyclopedic plant studies.
I mean, just to say about the kind of character of Jan Cho and then Sean Snyder is, in terms of like approaching how we program exhibitions, there's this, as Stefan already said, this interest in presenting positions that aren't known to the US kind of artist community. And Jan was really important in that sense. You know, he's now very well known. But
sometimes in curatorial life, every star align and you hit the full spot. That happens maybe twice a year. And with Jan, it happened that it was a very successful exhibition in terms of its reception, but for Jan itself, it was the right moment at the right time at the right place. He's now showing with Marion Goodman, won the Hugo Boss Prize, and bought several houses in Mexico. You know? But that's just a flip side of our doing that we can't control and won't control, because that's sort of the afterlife of, we don't do shows or exhibitions to make someone's career. But we also don't mind if it happens.
I think Sean Snyder is an interesting example there, because he is a US artist but hasn't lived in the US for quite a number of years, 10, 15 years, really didn't have kind of any kind of presence in the US.
But had several museums exhibition across Europe.
But as someone who isn't an easy artist to kind of slip into a kind of market kind of situation, you know, and not an easy artist in terms of the questions that he raises in his work, specifically around the politics of war and image production in the conditions of conflict, and also in relation to certain kind of interesting kind of overlaps in kind of creative production and politics. I'm just going to play another.
January 1985, Baghdad. In a special section of the article, the photographer writes of being brought on a bus with other journalists to a location where they were promised the best picture coverage. We weren't allowed to photograph anything from the bus. No pictures, they kept saying. 8 hours later, we arrived at Basra. Although we could walk around town, we couldn't take pictures. After shooting a few frames, we were told to leave. The article continues, New York on the Tigris. The 312-room Ishtar Sheraton Hotel was designed by an American architectural collaborative together with Iraqi engineers. In response to recent events in Baghdad, a hotels and resorts chain released a statement. The Sheraton Baghdad Hotel in Iraq has no direct or indirect association with the Sheraton brand since the Iraqi government confiscated the property after the first Gulf War. The Sheraton name in this instance is currently being used without our permission, and the hotel has not been part of our portfolio for more than 10 years. We look forward to the day we can safely return to Iraq and continue what was a long-term and successful history before the first Gulf War.
I think it's like that Sean's work so deals with kind of in that instance photojournalism, the character of images within kind of situations of conflict and how journalists capture those situations, but also this the way in which kind of those situations are co-opted by kind of globalized commerce. So the work is called Casio Seiko Sheraton Toyota Mars and follows how all those multinational organizations have had a footprint in Iraq and Afghanistan. But certainly this question of image production, an accelerated economy of images, is something that we've returned to often in our program in the last few years. It relates very clearly to our history with the pictures generation and questions around postmodernism and image production. So you'll see that further on. This is an exhibition by Mark Morrisroe, and Mark was involved in the exhibition Witnesses Against Our Vanishing. That exhibition in 1989 occurred literally months after Mark Morrisroe had passed away. He was a very important artist for that generation, but subsequently largely forgotten.
I mean, it's equally important position as Nan Goldin is. In fact, there are pictures where the authorship is not known. It could be Nan Goldin or it could be Mark Morrisroe. The estate, because no American museum wanted to buy the estate, is now in Switzerland at the museum in Winterthur, and till today, no major museum has a substantial holding of Mark Morrisroe's work, and even so, this exhibition was offered to several New York museums. They all turned it down. So we did it.
Hilary Lloyd, who's a British artist, again, someone who had zero visibility in the US at that time, someone who we thought was a very important figure to enter into a kind of discourse in New York around the production of specifically moving images in her case. And then this is a kind of moment at which we, in a sense, were addressing our history quite directly. Christopher D'Arcangelo was an artist who showed at Artist Space in the late 70s and 77. He was an artist whose work really existed outside of any institutional context, was very critical of the institution. He performed kind of guerrilla actions at the Whitney, at MoMA, and other organisations in New York and overseas, but his, because of that very nature of his work, that there was, he insisted on the kind of ephemerality of its documentation. It again had kind of disappeared totally, and also presented this problem of how to represent that practice, given that he kind of like...
I mean, one contribution to an exhibition with Louis Lawler, Cindy Sherman and Adrian Piper, for example, was that he erased his name from all publicity material. So literally there was no trace of him in the exhibition. That was his contribution to the exhibition. But I only pinned sort of a manifesto on the exhibition wall. Mm.
And so the way in which we dealt with that was the exhibition was purely made up of six interviews with people who had known D'Arcangelo, discussing both his work and his general character.
So this is a degree of self-referentiality, once again, that is much more radical than any of the conceptual artists up to that
Benjamin
moment
had
dared, namely recognizing that the place, the space, the practice, the text, the name are inevitably intertwined with an apparatus about which you have ultimately no control whatsoever. So this is an extraordinary step forward, again, once again, very, very different from what conceptual artists at that time had barely figured out. I mean, we talk about 5 years difference in the generational gap, so to speak. So nevertheless, what it also brings into focus, and this is the historical dark side of the project, is of course precisely the question that one would only understand with much thinking and much later hindsight, that the more radical the gesture of negation, the more radical the gesture of purification, the more radical the gesture of self-reflexivity will become, paradoxically, and this is a dialectic that I think nobody has figured out, at least not to my knowledge, paradoxically, it also approximates the condition of spectacularization. And I think that is Chris's tragedy in a certain way with all the other performances and all the other actions, that he is working precisely at that threshold, like nobody else had done, to my knowledge, of extreme analytic clarity, of extreme radical critique, of extreme precision in the analytic approach to the conditions of institutional production and reception. And by doing so, gets closer to the threshold of spectacularization than anybody else, never crossing it. I would never say that he crossed it, but bringing it closer to the threshold of spectacularization than anybody else, possibly already thinking about that inevitability. And then, of course, the work stops.
I mean, it's a kind of sad story, because D'Arcangelo committed suicide not long after the exhibition at Artist Space, and certainly his work was in a certain tension to that question of self-erasure, as Stefan pointed out. But someone who we felt was so,
I mean, his first exhibition at Artist Space in the '70s, not now.
Yeah, but so important to consider at this stage, and with a kind of younger artist community thinking about institutional critique, the history of institutional critique, and what it means today.
Just as a brief insert, it would be far too evening filling. As a flip side of this exhibition, Artist Space also got back then occupied by Occupy Wall Street, because once we proclaim such a degree of criticality, we should also be the host for. So that was a bit of a dilemma.
And in a kind of lineage with that exhibition, we worked for quite a long time on a research project with Dexter Sinister, who are kind of collaborative of designers, editors, writers, on this project around the nature of institutional branding, something that we kind of take for granted with museums and so on, that there's this high level of identity that's projected by the institution, and that sometimes sits in front of the actual program that we experience as a kind of a veneer, if you like. And they produced this three-screen animation that really went into a history of three institutions, the Pompidou, MoMA, and Tate's institutional branding.
In the newly rebranded organization, the former Tate Gallery was renamed Tate Britain, and the new one, Tate Modern. What Ollens was proposing was that the consumable brand was fluid. First came the brand, then came the product. The danger is that it's just talk. Then again, the danger is that it's not. I believe you can speak things into existence. 2009. The director repeated his mantra. All multi-art spaces are rethinking what they need to do. The new vision was one of flexibility, spontaneity, and itinerant programming. A more fluid and decentered model, a sometime festival, a free-form space, a particular mood or movement, and an obsession with the mobile taste of the public as the final arbiter of cultural value. All that matters is now. 2004. If you raise a lot of money, I will give you great, great architecture. But if you raise really a lot of money, I will make the architecture disappear. So promised architect Yoshio Taniguchi when he began the revamp of the Museum of Modern Art. $450 million later, his koan has stuck. The building's hefty price tag seems to point to invisibility as a new kind of luxury. The museum also hired graphic designer Bruce Mab to redesign MoMA's identity. But Mab felt the existing logo, set in Franklin Gothic type, should be left alone. Everybody gets tired of their own voice, and so they want to change it. But I was like, don't mess with it. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Mann noticed, however, that somewhere in its evolution from the original 1902 metal type to the digital version, MoMA's Franklin had lost some of its spirit. The museum approached typographer Matthew Carter about refreshing the typeface, which was, he said, like asking an architect to design an exact replica of a building.
So I'm going to maybe go quite fast with this. This is an exhibition with a young artist collective from New York. We're running out of time. A kind of project that was initiated by the writer Chris Krauss around a space in Mexicali called Mexicali Rose. It was really dealing with border politics in Mexicali, but also the thriving art scene there, and the way that this particular space was kind of very highly responsible for generating that particular art scene, and working with teenagers in the area to do documentary workshops and so on. And that included a kind of two-day symposium around a publication called The Femicide Machine, which really was addressing the huge level of kind of murders of women in along the border, particularly around Mexicali and Tijuana. And then an important project for us with Bernadette Corporation. I don't know whether you know of Bernadette Corporation, but they're a New York-based artist collective who have been... it's kind of like their 20th... It was their 20-year anniversary in 2013, if you like. And we felt it was a kind of moment at which to do a kind of retrospective. But given the nature of Bernadette Corporation, who very much play with the idea of artistic subjectivity and identity, the idea of doing a retrospective and self-historicizing kind of created its own engine for an exhibition. And what they came up with was this incredible... They worked with a designer who typically works with Chanel and Dior and people doing fashion kind of related projects, and asked him to design a kind of an architecture for them to recast their history. So they literally went back across all the work they've made over 20 years and essentially represented that work in a new way within this kind of very slick corporate kind of architecture. And there was also a kind of timeline that went through each year of their history and described the kind of... They're basically a collective that has worked across fashion and design, activism, public publishing. So the early years were based around Bernadette Corporation as a fashion label. At a period in New York when... there was a kind of notion of avant-garde fashion, that fashion had potential, or there was a resonance within that community of there being potential for fashion to have an alternative edge, still be politicized in certain ways. And then a group exhibition called Frozen Lakes, which occurred in 2012 or 2013, in the year of our kind of 40th anniversary. And really, we decided to kind of look towards the pictures exhibition as a seminal moment in our history and address something that we felt very palpably was important for younger artists, which is, how do we kind of consider the production of images, the circulation and flow of images in a contemporary moment in which we're all familiar with the accelerated speed at which images can move globally. So this question was around shifting a kind of postmodernist question of critique around image production towards image circulation and the way images behave as they circulate
in a now digital economy. So.
So this exhibition included work by artists based in New York, but internationally as well, younger generation of artists, such as Ed Atkins, and the previous slide was Ken Akishi. This is Ed Atkins again. This is Shadi Habib Allah, who's a New York-based artist. The kind of quality of the flow of our programming, we certainly, as we said before, we try and relate how these kind of things connect. Zilia Sanchez is an artist who is based in Puerto Rico. She's in her late 80s. She's a Cuban artist, someone who we discovered through various kind of artist friend networks, but someone who really hadn't been exhibited in the US since the 70s. She lived in New York for a brief period of time, but whose work we felt was kind of like a missing element within the history of minimalism, or post-minimalism in a way. Someone who makes these fantastically kind of sensual, shaped canvases, and has been doing so since the 50s, essentially. So incredible historical position, but one we felt needed to be readdressed, and we wanted to create that kind of catalyst for that to happen.
These are all historical works, mostly.
This is a work that she began in the 60s and carried on working on until the 90s. And drawing is also an important part of her practice. And she's also the graphic designer for a kind of radical literary publication in Puerto Rico in the early 70s called Zona.
Let's speak.
Yeah, we're gonna go quite fast because we're running out of time. But what we... Perhaps this is a good slide in showing our second venue that Terry mentioned at the beginning, called Artist Space Books and Talks, which I think we might skip straight forward to. Or maybe we'll talk about Julie's show briefly. We're going to talk about the current exhibition and then briefly move on to talk about Artist Space Books and Talks, but... Macho Man Till It's My Heart, collected by Julie Ault, is based around the collection of the artist Julie Ault. Julie is someone who takes on the kind of title of artist and uses it as a kind of a screen, if you like, for multiple activities that might otherwise be termed curating or editing. She was a member of Group Material from 1979 to 1996, when Group Material ended. An artist collective that was very important in New York and globally in the 80s, particularly as a kind of politicized practice, a practice that tried to address the crossover between aesthetics and social practice. But Julie, as a result of very sustained engagements with a number of artists over the years, has built up a collection through the gifting of work to her by those artists. And it's
For us, sort of the motivation part behind the exhibition was in a such an overhyped economical climate, to be mindful and a reminder of what also constitutes a collection, that a collection is not just bling on purchase value and auction results, that a collection is also can also be a social organism of inter-exchanging works with other artists, getting things gifted, and in a way it's sort of a sub-economy to the official economy, and that a collection can also constitute a sum of social relationships.
Yeah, so the exhibition includes some central kind of artists such as Andre Serrano, who Julie was married to for 10 years, Leon Golub and Nancy Spiro, who are really kind of important figures for her, and
Ronnie Horn,
and Felix Gonzalez Torres, who was a member of Group Material and a very close friend, Julie's. But all these relationships are there and are represented by artworks as artifacts, if you like, because of the depth of conversations that Julie has had with those artists over the years, and the ways in which those discourses have been made palpable within Julie's practice, which is often exhibition-based or publication-based. This is work by, on the left, Martin Wong, and on the right by Yan Vo, reflecting on Martin Wong's work. Martin being a figure who was very close with Julie and very important to Julie in the 80s, also sadly passed away through AIDS-related illnesses in the early 90s. And this showing work of mainly by his sister Carita Kent, someone who Julie really cast a light on in the early 2000s, late 1990s, someone that she, in a way, rediscovered and decided that, well, kind of very clearly felt very passionate about reintroducing to an art audience, a radical Catholic nun, who made these amazing screen prints in the 60s that clearly related to pop art, and she was much kind of engaged with that discourse. She actually left the church in the 60s due to some kind of a lot of fallings out with the Catholic Church. And mixed in to this arrangement is work by Andre Serrano, so it's very interesting to consider the contentious nature of Serrano's work in relation to how the Catholic Church perceived his work in the 80s and the kind of activism of Sister Carita. So just to kind of like bring to a close in a way to talk about Artist Space Books and Talks, which is somewhere, a second venue that we opened in 2012.
I mean, before we always used to do talks like these in the exhibition space on 38 Green Street. But they were so popular that we felt the need to expand and in a way expand vertically rather than horizontally, and opened a second venue that is dedicated to discussion, really. It also has a bookshop. It's a bookshop based on choices of 100 individuals, most of them artists, that each contributed 10 titles to the bookshop. And currently we host up to 2-3 events a week at that space, because you have to understand that all larger institutions in New York don't keep the doors open for these kind of situations as we have them here, because it's far too costly.
But also the character of the space is heavily formulated around discourse and the quality of the discursive as a really important central feature to artists working today, kind of reasserting the emphasis less on exhibition making, less on the object, more on the notion of the event. And I think this is really kind of borne out by the way in which the space has become such a kind of social hub for people, and ways of thinking newly about either theoretical positions or kind of artist production positions that use the event structure as a way of working. It's used by regular groups to meet in the space, and it really kind of engages with the history of artist space that in the 70s was used by multiple kind of communities, if you like, overlapping. Artist Workers Coalition met at artist space in the 70s. It was a radical kind of political voice. And similarly, we have people using the space who kind of work through those kind of ways of those modes of activism. We've also used the space in two occasions recently as a space for doing more archival exhibitions, thinking about a kind of third space of the discursive, around secondary material related to artists' practices. So this exhibition was based around the work of André Cadoret, a French artist active in the 1970s, who again sadly died quite young, whose work was largely based around actions, although he kind of like made very specific documentation of those works, and also he's well known for these objects, the round bars of wood that were kind of activated through their use in public space. So there was a really kind of dense archival exhibition of documents around his work.
It's an exhibition that certainly function on a very, very different speed that you really have to dive into. It's like more like a study room.
And this exhibition of the work of Richard Hollis, British graphic designer, who's been kind of a real innovator in terms of graphic design histories, but particularly in relation to socialist design and connection to the cultural sphere. He was really someone who kind of was a forerunner of particular practices, design practices now that fuse or kind of work more actively in the contemporary art sphere as a space of potential for design. So he worked for many years with the Whitechapel, designing their kind of artistic identity and their material. So in a way, it's kind of going back to that discourse around institutional identity and how design functions within that. This is a poster that he produced for kind of an art school in London in the 70s, where there was a very kind of radical political movement in art schools at that time, and lots of sit-ins and protests. So that's our final slide. But I think that gives an indication of our overarching program, but also this quality between our exhibition space and books and talks, how they sit together, and hopefully we develop certain strands across our programming in that way. So maybe we can go into questions. We've gone on for so long.
It was supposed to be half an hour. It was an hour.
It's over an hour. But yeah, if anybody's got any questions about...
You started off talking about the artists that were being served by galleries and museums, and that's how this was birthed. Right now, in our community, we have urban pop-up galleries where artists can show their work in someone's home, in a salon, in a street that's blocked off. There's a huge hunger with the artists in this area and everywhere else to have their work seen. It's a DIY society for us. We get on Facebook. We're making a way for people to see our art, and we're allowing the public to make a decision on whether it's worthy or not. Do you think...
Why do you think
that's where...
No, just the public makes a decision if it's worthy or not.
Well, it's pretty much like whether they're going to stay, take a look, have a conversation, okay, whether they're going to buy it or not. It's a celebration. It's a collective. And what I see going on, that I'm with artists that are visual, performance artists, sculptors, musicians, we're bounded together. Because there's nowhere to go. What do we do? Are we on the right track?
I would not dare to speak for the local context of Dallas or Fort Worth.
I don't think it's local. Because, you know, internet, Facebook, it's everywhere. So where are we going in the future?
I mean, I think it's very important to think about a certain history of artist-led spaces, artist-run spaces, and the alternative space movement in New York is certainly a kind of example of that. And you can see equivalences in certain periods where there's a lack of facility for artists to work, and there's a need to generate those situations through the artist community. I think one of the important things to consider when that's happening is... In what direction is that heading? Is it all about just attaining visibility in order to have artistic careers? You know, what is that kind of idea of the career for artists. And I think that it's, you know, I think it's an important thing to keep hold of that quality of the grassroots kind of energy that comes from those kind of situations, and not to become overly institutionalized, essentially. I think it's a really great place to be, but it's, you know, it's also about building a critical framework to really challenge the work in that situation, not just kind of be happy with it being because there's nothing else happening, you know. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also, you know, like in this, you see the Smithson show in Dallas, people used to go away from the center to get out of the pressure and out of those mechanisms, and now everybody seems to be geared only with one single viewpoint, and that is the center, and that is the money. Yeah, I think it's more complicated than that, and it can also be much more fun than not being in New York.
I mean, that one show that we showed some slides from, it was titled Radical Localism, formulated around a position from the writer Chris Krauss, this idea of radical localism, particular to Mexicali, where one could visit Mexicali and say, well, this is devoid of any interesting contemporary art, and where in actual fact it's got this incredibly vibrant grassroots kind of scene that doesn't need museums, it doesn't need institutions to function. It's really volatile situation because there's no funding, and it's socially a very difficult situation to work in. But this one guy, Marco Vera, who runs Mexicali Rose, was making it happen to a great extent. And in that situation, you kind of feel like, well, you know, there's a kind of sense in which that generates its own kind of critical framework, and it really was working well in Mexicali. And I think that's important that becomes, you know, in a way, kind of more interesting than something that's surrounding us in New York, which is a very kind of blasé attitude towards what contemporary art is and what it can be.
Thank you. Kind of to follow that up, what I was struck by the history of the space, that it seems like maybe it has moved from the artist's voice to a curatorial voice. That you definitely, Stefan, you made a shift, you know, this idea of local emerging, and then you made a shift in terms of the art you were presenting. And could you speak to that, and maybe to go back to what you said, Richard, in response to this question, that it depends on that criticality, you know, was that part of that decision? So there was that critical voice. So there was, because if you're planning 2 years out, you're making some decisions about what is and what's going to be important within that time frame. You're not leaving it kind of open to whatever presents itself, which is, I sense, more of the roots or the way that space began.
Yes, certainly. As much as the space began in a very different cultural, economical circumstances, as much you have to rethink the legacy of that space. And that space became very, very quickly a space for a certain position that it took, a legacy that it has, that is identity politics, pictures, you know, like just this one exhibition alone sort of defines sort of the ideological framework of our organization. And then, of course, the context itself has changed so drastically that I think we do not actually do necessarily service, besides maybe creating jealousy among artists, if you exhibit one artist, young artist, emerging artist, above the other. I think the dialogue has to be far more meaningful, and is actually more meaningful, as we can show, in terms of the perception of our programming, that its relevance, and its relevance unfolds in the participation of the local artist community. And I don't think the local artist community came to us. Nobody, board members sometimes ask that, but no artist ever came to us, why don't you show me or local artists? They find what we do enriching their horizon, bringing people together and challenging them, and far more enriching than just showing them. That said, we do work constantly on different programs and exhibitions with local artists, such as Duox in in March 15th, we open exhibition with a younger New York-based artist, Sam Pulitzer. So it does happen too.
But a good example of that is that one of the formative programs of ArtSpace was the slide registry, where this was a kind of new idea, was that artists could bring their slides into ArtSpace, it would be held on file. It was used quite heavily by curators, galleries, and so on. ArtSpace's exhibitions, a certain amount each year were selected from the slide registry. Ham Steinbach had his first show at ArtSpace chosen from the slide registry, along with several other artists. But the slide registry now is like 13,000 people. And, it's just impossible to deal with that. It's like growing daily.
Obviously, anymore. It's online.
But. Yeah, it's online. It's digital. And it can be accessed and people upload their work, which is fantastic. But it's not the same way in which it can be kind of digested and worked with. So that speaks to this shifting kind of landscape, I think.
But also, we do want to be a sort of buffer and a critical voice as art just purely as a career option, And this is also our legacy. Art was not a career option in the early 70s. And that it has become one, that's another matter. But I think we can work with every artist we want to work with so long it unfolds meaning and it's meaningful to the constituency that we serve and that other artists in New York.
Yeah,
established or, emerging, I don't give a damn.
Yeah.
I really don't care.
I just wanted to ask about the institution's definition of what an artist is, because it seems that the programming definitely reflects like an expansion of the term, certainly with Julie Ault's work, Group Material, and Bernadette Corporation. But I wonder if there, in your mind or in the institution's mind, there's a limit to what the definition could include.